Hey, Curiosity Builders, I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative entrepreneurs, storytellers, visionaries, and changemakers who are on a mission of chasing big ideas, telling epic stories, and leaving living legacies. Whether you're just starting out or have been at this creative and curious life for some time, I hope you learn something new in this podcast and find yourself inspired to break through the barriers that hold you back and keep you stuck from getting your work to work. How can people work together better? Is a question that fuels the curiosity and drive of today's guest on Getting Work to Work, Iggy Perillo. Iggy is a leadership coach who helps people discover what makes them awesome and creates psychologically safe spaces for them to engage with difficult challenges. In this conversation, we talk a lot about books and her awesome podcast, All About Books, how she shares knowledge and wisdom with people, and how to maintain energy through constant experimentation. We also talk a lot about authenticity, her approach to mastery, and the importance of understanding what we can and cannot control. Show notes and links to all the good stuff mentioned in this episode can be found at gwtw.co/487. Iggy, welcome to Getting Work to Work. It's wonderful to talk with you today.
I'm so excited to be talking with you too, Chris.
Awesome. I am really excited to talk with you. And I would love to know right out of the gate, what are you endlessly curious about?
I am endlessly curious about how people can work together better. I am thinking about this and I feel like it guides a lot of what I do, but also it's just something I see whenever I see people, relationships with people. I'm like, how do they work together better? Like how, yeah, it's always on my mind.
Where does that curiosity come from? Are you like a sports fan? Are you really interested in watching people work? Or, you know, where does that come from?
I do love sports. That's true. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time with folks, like literally doing team, like I say team development, people say team building. I feel like there's this difference that team building as a term has gotten this kind of rap as like, oh, well, we're going to go play games and like throw everyone off a cliff and yay, we built a team. You know, it's like kind of been overdone. Like, oh, trust falls, team building. I'm like, never do trust falls. People, those are old school. Anyway, but from this sort of very physical sense of team building, I led expeditions and wilderness expeditions for a long time where strangers show up and then they have to get places. And so seeing this team form together, as well as like the individual growth that's happening, you know, it's like in parallel. So I think I've spent a lot of time doing that. But I think even before that, I was always into sports and into things like that where teams and groups are functioning. And just that idea where more can happen and more can be done when you have a group of people versus an individual is, you know, like the most obvious statement of the universe. But it's but it can be done well and can be done super duper poorly, both. So I think it's like we see both out there, examples on sports and in life and in, you know, relationships with people or businesses, whatever it is, like all those contexts.
Oh, that's interesting. And so as someone who's fascinated with how people work together, where do you usually start looking at?
I start with, do people even have a shared goal that is obvious and known? Like it might be obvious, but it might be unknown. I don't know. Like maybe that's like some weird like verbal judo there. But I think people assume that they're on the same page and they're not. And that is the part that's fascinating to me as a like, oh, we're all on the same team. Like we're all here for the same reason. We're all in the same company. We're all, you know, whatever, playing the same sport together. But people have actually super different goals simultaneously that get sort of ignored or assumed. There's a lot of assumptions that happen. And then it comes out later when people are like, well, why are you acting like that? Or why is this happening? And you realize that people don't actually have the same goals for that same team. And so I think that is a huge part. Same goals, same values that underline like how the team should operate, how the goal should be pursued. And I think there's these pieces about culture that are really fascinating too, which is kind of the how things get done around here with these people piece.
So fascinating. And what's interesting is like, as you, as even in the 3.5 minutes that we've been talking, I start to get a glimpse into how you operate and what you're really interested in. And something that I just, that I saw on your website is a good entry point into this conversation, and that you love to help people discover what makes them awesome.
Yeah. I think people don't know sometimes. And like, it's not like I'm the Socratic midwife, right? And Socrates like brought knowledge into the world. But I think there's this part where people have a lot of habits and ways they operate that are pretty good or pretty functional. But I think there's often, I mean, I'm a lifelong learner, committed to always learning, always growing. Mm-hmm. And I think that is possible for anyone to always learn, mm-hmm. always grow, which is always being more awesome and progressing in different ways, you know?
Mm-hmm. So what makes you awesome? I thought I'd turn that question on its head and ask you straight up. This is a humble free zone, by the way.
Yeah, I know.
Let it fly.
Can I just say humility? No, just kidding. I am really good at creating psychologically safe spaces for people to engage with difficult challenges together. So whether that's a team traveling together that need to like really bond and become a strong team, or a organization I'm working with where people might not be on the same page or might have had communication breakdown, or I facilitate mastermind groups where people bring their challenges and they need to be able to share those challenges with people who are, they may not have known very long, or and have to build this sense of trust and connection with. And that psychological safety is the container where people can bring challenges, bring celebrations, bring all these things together for their own growth and development, and to support each other in that those team spaces or mastermind spaces. So that's one thing I'm pretty good at doing, unhumbly speaking.
Unhumbly speaking, I like that. And what I like about that too is, again, I think it's there's an assumption that can be made about what is a psychologically safe space. But what is a psychologically safe space?
That is a great question. I'm sure, I know, not even I'm sure, like there are very researched definitions out there in social theory and in cognitive science fields. And I would say my operating definition is a psychologically safe space is a place where people can agree and disagree and be authentic. And the consequences of that are not dire in a way that I don't know, going right to consequences makes it seem like, oh, people get a beat down for that. But I think it's a space where people can be authentic, agree and disagree. And authenticity, I think there's this, you know, big, like, let's throw a party for authenticity kind of popular notion of like, well, I'm being real. And sometimes
candor.
Yeah. And sometimes it's like, well, I'm unfiltered. This is me being authentic. I'm like, no, you're just being a jerk. Like, and like to create a psychologically safe space is like, yeah, maybe you are a jerk. And maybe someone's gonna be like, you're being a jerk. And that's a conversation that can happen in a psychologically safe space that can't happen necessarily in a space where there's a power dynamic, for example, where I'm the boss and I'm a jerk and everyone just sucks it up, you know, or whatever, you know, like these kind of, I think power dynamics kind of destroy psychological safety in some ways and sometimes, it, not always, but it can very easily, people can fall into those habits of deference or being deferential to people in power dynamic spaces that don't let them be authentic in the lesser power role. So I think psychologically safe spaces, now that I've like talked around this for 10 minutes, like psychologically safe spaces create, like allow for sort of an even power dynamic to occur in terms of authenticity of people and communication that happens. And they're not spaces of agreement or spaces of like we're all on the same page necessarily, other than that we agree to engage. It's like the definition of discourse. I studied philosophy and there's like discourse where you're like, oh yeah, we're chatting. It's discourse. You're like, no way. Discourse is where you're really engaged in a really technical level of listening and understanding and processing what's happening. So I feel like psychologically safe spaces are the sort of deeper level of being present and listening and being accepting to authenticity.
And do these spaces require an understanding of goals and values and the things that make teams function better?
I think they require commitment.
Ooh.
And I would say separate from the goals or values. I think there's, like you can have a psychologically safe space with totally different goals and totally different values. You have to value psychological safety, I guess, for that, you know, sort of baseline to be present, right?
Yeah.
But I think you can have like really drastic disagreements. I think they, one of the examples that I was reading about recently was the sort of 70s Saturday Night Live writer's room, where there are all these writers coming up and they're writing these really avant-garde or racy kind of things. And people would like just throw each other's stuff in the trash, or people would yell at each other, or people would be like, that's terrible or not funny, you know? And so there was like a lot of like energy and sort of argument seeming, but it was fundamentally really psychologically safe space, because then people could come back and still be authentic and be real and still bring up their idea or still like bring things forward into that space, even if it wasn't, you know, not everything was like universally accepted. And that was part of how that space operated at that time with those personalities. So they were committed to, I guess, their bigger goal, but also to having a space where no one got shot down and just like kicked out.
Yeah. I like that description a lot because I start to get an understanding of how you operate as a leadership coach, where you want to create these psychological safe spaces that allow for groups to commit to one another, commit to a goal or a value. And as you're thinking about it, I can see why the teams that maybe I've been on in the past haven't been as functional as I probably would have wanted them to be. And so as a leadership coach, is this the work that you do? Is this really what the work is getting at? Is this psychologically safe space, or is that just the beginning of it?
That's a piece of it, I guess. I sort of don't know how to answer because it's ingrained in a lot of it. And sometimes people are not able to engage in a psychologically safe space. Like that's just not how they operate. That's not my relation to that group or that that team at that time. Like it's my role. Like that's what I'm working on, but it's not always achieved, I guess. Yeah. And sometimes it's like, cool, I guess we're not going to like, this is not going to happen. We're going to talk about tools you can use with this group of people. You know, like there are different tacks I can take to get to the same increasing team functionality, helping people work together better and helping people be more awesome. Like there are ways to get at that are a lot easier if they're in a psychologically safe space and can co-support each other and can co-develop each other and can raise each other up. But that takes, again, that level of commitment that not everyone has. Fine, fair enough. And so there are other ways to, kind of work around that. Or I work with individuals one-on-one, or I work with whole teams, intact teams together on like their specific challenge that they're facing at the moment. So it is a thread through it all, but not necessarily the only thread, I guess. An important one, like an ideal one, if we can get that nailed down, things are going to be a lot smoother and a lot more amazing, a lot faster, but you work with what you got.
I'm curious when you discovered the title of leadership coach and when you're like, this is what I want to do, because coming from a sports background, coming from, your wilderness training time, what was it when you saw this that you're like, yes?
Well, I did the thing you're not supposed to do technically when building a business. And like, I'm like, I need a business card first. And so, everyone's like, no, you come up with your ideas and then blah, blah, blah. I'm like, no, I need a business card, which means I need a logo, which sort of means I need a title right away. And so I started with that part, and it became this reflection on what have I been doing for other organizations or other people that I really enjoyed and that I want to do for myself. There was a time where I was really focused on recreating my work that I had done for other people as an individual, and that didn't work well for me. Like it's all in the same boat of leadership development and team development, but how I was going about it was not authentic to my own model of how I wanted it to be done. So there's this sort of evolution of thought around sort of my entrepreneurial journey of, this is what I like doing. This is what I like doing. This is what I've been doing for the past 20 years. Like, here's actually how I want to enact that for myself. And then I sort of needed a title to go with it. And so the title coach like is still like, okay, I guess that's what I do. Because I think there's a lot of folks, it's like, for one, it's really accessible. Like you can call yourself a coach tomorrow and slap it on your business card like I did. And everyone's like, oh, great, congratulations. Like there's no certification to be a leadership coach, like whatever. I know there are obviously like life coaching, you can get a certification, or sports coaching. There's definitely certifications in those fields. And like there are specialized coaching certifications, but like, I found leadership coach to be one that had no firm definition, which made it very accessible for me. And yet it sounded fancy when I wrote it on my business card. So I'm like, I'm doing it.
Nice.
Yeah. Not a great answer maybe, but here we are. And I have titles. My business card has gone through all these titles. Like, oh, I'm the owner. I'm the founder. I'm the principal. I'm the, whatever. Like you got to have, for some reason, I was very attached to thing number one, business card that I felt was fancy. So there we are. So now I have a business. It's formal.
I appreciate that, though. While it may not feel like a great answer, I think it's the honest answer, because I know for myself that was my journey as well.
Oh, yeah.
This is what I want. This is the title. This is what I'm doing. And it isn't until I think you go through that over and over again that you start to connect to the other side of it, of this is the work that I'm doing. This is the value that I bring. These are the problems that I'm interested in solving. And however you get there is however you get there.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Like, I think it is defined by the problems you're solving. Mm-hmm. But I guess for me, it was like a reflective moment of,
yeah,
here's the problems I've been solving. Like, oh yeah, this is what you call those problems I've been solving. Mm-hmm. Cool. It sounds like you've had a similar path to get to where you are.
Very, very much so. And I resonate so much with the whole, ooh, I'm going to call myself this. And I think for me, I'm on a journey of coach as well. And what I appreciate about that label is that I'm looking for examples where, oh, I like that picture right there. That is the kind of coach that I want to be. So, for example, I look at like a record producer who works with a band to bring out their best. And maybe there's some input into the creative, but really it's about getting them to really perform better. And I like that model for myself, but was there a model for you where you looked at an example in the world and you're like, yes, that right there is what I want to be?
Not exactly, but your example makes me, have you seen the movie Monster about Metallica?
Oh, yes. I love that one. Some Kind of Monster. Yes.
Oh, that's what it's called. Right, right. I remember watching it and being like, and so the band, for folks that haven't seen it, the band Metallica, who's been around for at least, I think, decades by this time, one of the guys is like, I'm going to buy a documentary with all my money. And they're like, cool. And so one of the things that they show is that they have this psychologist come in and work with the band and kind of help them work together better in this way. And then the psychologist gets like a little overattached, it seems like, down as things evolve, is my interpretation of what happens. And then he's kind of bummed. He's like, oh, why am I not such an important piece of this band? You know, like he just... Mm-hmm. But there's this part where I'm like, oh, like a band could hire someone to like help them really function together better. And that's how I saw his role playing out, even though he was more of a psychological psychiatrist or psychiatrist style counselor was his background. And my background's more education and human development.
Okay.
But I feel like that example, I was like, oh, anyone, any group of people could have someone help them work together better. So although I don't want to be like that dude, and someone brought this example up to me recently, was like, have you seen this movie? That's kind of like what you're doing for our team. I'm like, thanks, I hope. And the good parts of it, you know, it was
that's right.
They meant it as a compliment. And I took it as a compliment for sure. But that idea that, oh, anyone can use this skill and I have this skill. Like that's what that example showed to me. I'm like, oh, like any group of people. Yeah. So it like kind of was like a door opening moment. But before that, I'd been like just floundering around doing it anyway, you know, like, but that was when I was like, oh yeah, like this is a thing that people do.
I'm really interested, Iggy, because as you're talking, I can tell that there's so many thoughts running through your head and there's so many ideas that you're churning through. And how do you not get stuck in your brain?
I think I'm too busy. Like I have too much to do. I'm a little bit of a list maker. So, you know, I have things on my list, on my calendar that I need to do and deadlines that either I've set or I've set for myself. So, I mean, I don't know that I have time to get stuck in my brain, but I also find a ton of value in, I run every day currently, mostly every day. And I run like, let's dial that back. I sort of jog around the neighborhood and, which is an important distinction because if my heart rate was too high, I wouldn't be able to process thoughts. So I actually am very slow and cruising around. And I listen to audiobooks often, but I also sometimes just run, you know, with nothing. And like, that gives me that time to sort of think and process and plan things out and, you know, do stuff without a screen in front of me or a list to take notes on or whatever. It's just that I give my mind that space to be thinking either practically or strategically or, you know, wanderingly, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah.
So I think I just maybe creating space for that, but also I'm pretty good at directing my energy to the task at hand or the goal of the moment the long-term goal. You know, like I think I can let things fit together, but also turn it off and go watch a movie. Like I'm okay with that too.
Yeah. I appreciate that a lot because sometimes when you have so many thoughts running through your head, if you don't have a way to channel that into action, I think it can paralyze you. So it sounds like you've really developed some systems so that you can take that thinking and pour it into the work.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm also a really big experimenter, and I'm not held back by trying new things. And sometimes they are great, and sometimes I'm like, whoa, I just have a workshop that one person signed up for. That's fun and weird, and that's going to be really private, fun experience. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it just, they don't all go, I mean, they're experiments. They're not, like, as hoped for, I guess, but like, the point of an experiment is that they could go how they're going to go, and you learn from that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like that emphasis too on experiment. And because sometimes, again, I'm just going to speak for myself. You get this idea in your head and you're like, okay, I want to do this workshop. And then you're like, but what if no one signs up? And then you don't do it. But I like the fact that you put it out there and you got one person. And then your mindset is so like positive and growth oriented that you're like, hey, one person, totally private, going to be a different experience, but we're going to learn something. I mean, that alone is amazing.
Thanks. To me, it's just more experiments. And I think I'm not always the most scientific with my experiments. So if I was a really good experimenter, you know, it'd be like all like A-B testing and like, okay, well, this headline. And then I'm right now experimenting with different times to offer workshops. Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, what time? Yeah. So I'm offering them all three times at, you know, a weekend time, an afternoon, an evening time, and a daytime. But that's for my time zone. And so every other time zone, that's a whole, you know, different ball of wax. And I'm not settled yet. So I have like a lot of workshops offered and a lot of times that probably no one is going to sign up for some of them. And I'm okay with that. You know, like some of those time slots, like that's the learning part, is that some of them won't happen, which is okay.
What has been one of the most difficult challenges in your business that you've overcome, and how did you go about doing that?
This is a great question, and I don't know. I don't have a long memory for most difficult challenge. It's just kind of like, to me, the most recent challenge that I've overcome is really what comes to mind more than, I don't have a most difficult. I know people do have a story where like, nothing was happening, and then this thing, and you're like, I don't have a single moment. But I think for me, the sort of ongoing challenge is really represented by all these experiments I'm trying constantly. Like, oh, should I do more workshops? Should I focus on more specialized communities? Like, how do I connect with these communities? Oh, these communities are all different. How do I connect with this one versus that one, or doing these different things? So, I think the challenge is fundamentally for me, the like just my growth as an entrepreneur, I suppose, you know, which is kind of another cheese ball answer, but it is like, well, how do I do this next thing I want to do? Or how do I try this out? Or how do I figure out how to connect with veterinarians versus triathletes versus roller derby league leadership versus parents versus people engaged in anti-racism work versus people who are focused on leadership, like within an organization as itself. So I'm a huge believer in the eudaimonic sense of happiness. So like a good life is defined by the purpose of striving versus the purpose of achieving. So a tangible thing at the end. And so putting myself in this state of striving, which constant experiments, trying new things, like really posting kind of audacious amounts of things that I'm like, I'll just throw this out there and see what happens. Like I have an inkling, you know, it's not just like random, like anything in the universe. It's like, I think I know, like I have some sense. But to me, it's a lot of journey and exploration. And, you know, some stuff goes nowhere. And some stuff is, I mean, not a total failure, but like I'm constantly tinkering with my website or constantly tinkering with how to connect with this thing or that thing or how to build this relationship or do this other thing. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't know that there's any one challenge I've overcome, but it's like the challenge of maybe of maintaining energy through all these constant challenges or maintaining creative focus or maintaining will, you know, to keep going when, you know, there's ups and downs, obviously, but like there's always more challenges to try, more experiments to work out.
Yeah. I love that a lot. And it, as you talked about the distinction between striving and achieving, I was thinking about mastery. And is mastery the result of striving or is it the result of achieving?
When you say mastery, I think of Daniel Pink's book, Drive, and how he talks about mastery is a piece of motivation, that we have to have a sense of mastery in order to feel motivated. His definition of mastery is that you have quantifiable progress or qualifiable, that there's progress that is somehow noted or measurable. You know, like there's tons of qualitative things that are noted and measurable in some sense, or notable. And I think that mastery is progress in the direction that you want to go. I don't know.
It's a little bit of a mind nugget.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's a great question. I think mastery is just a sense that you're making progress. And so, yeah, I mean, it's important. I would lose motivation if I didn't think I was making progress. But I think there's also change that happens that I'm like, yeah, I just, you know, tweaked a section of my website. Is that, did I master it? I'm like, no, I don't know. I'm going to tweak it again probably next week. But I'm like, oh, here's a better way to say that. Or, you know, like, whatever. You know, I'll get a new idea or a rephrase something.
It's really interesting because, you know, the thing that you were describing about mastering your website, like, is that really something that you master or need to master? Or is that experimentation and refinement enough?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's this like dream, right, that I have like the exact right words and suddenly like a million people flood my email with like, hire me right now, you know, like whatever. I don't. Yeah, that's like this amazing vision dream. And I don't think that's going to happen based on me using a period instead of a semicolon. You know, like that's not the result of that. Most likely. I mean, maybe it is. Suddenly people will be like, the semicolon was throwing me off the whole time. But I think, yeah. That's why I think I struggle with the idea of mastery in the sense of it's done, you know, it's completed. I've mastered it versus mastery as a verb for like, oh, this is a thing we're doing. We're in the engaging in mastery right now, as in striving, which then fits with eudaimonia, which is all fine for me. So I'm all for striving.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And it helps me to think more about balancing the needs of mastery with being responsive. Because to me, if you're like approaching mastery, it's like, how can you be flexible and responsive in the moment when sometimes you have to just, sometimes you have to posture a little bit or fake out the opponent, you know, with your, you know, you have to bluff sometimes. And that sometimes goes against mastery, I think.
It's part of the game. I recently read this great book. Oh no, I'm going to forget the title. About basically is this woman who, I'm going to forget the author too. This is terrible. I'll find it later and send it to you. But she decided she didn't know how to play poker at all and decided she was going to learn and become a professional poker player within a year.
Is this Annie Duke's book?
Maybe. Yeah. I think that's familiar. What's the title of it though? I forget. She has a great title. It's so beautiful. But she talks about how she tells people she's going to go learn to play poker and her grandma is like, why are you going to go learn to be a liar? Like, that's not, you know, like, that's so uncool. Like, don't be a liar. Don't be mean to people. Don't bluff. And she's like, bluffing's not lying. You know, it's like, it's part of the game. Like, within the structure, you have to put on a front sometimes, or you have to understand the psychology of the other person. So they, and how they're reading you. So what you are doing is communicating one thing to them when in reality, your cards are different, you know? And she would say that, I think somewhere in there, there's a stat that like, only 30% of the time do the poker player with the best hand, the best cards, they only win 30% of the time. So the other, whatever, 70% of the time is the person who plays the best. So that's like the skill. You know, that's why poker is a game of skill, not a game of chance, la, 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 all these other things. And so this part about bluffing is part of it that, and so she has to go through this, like argue with people all the time that she's not a liar, you know, essentially. It's like kind of this like theme that comes up again and again in the book. Like, oh, you're just one of those lying poker players that's just trying to scam everyone. And she's like, no. And she meets some of these characters who are like actual cheaters, you know, of the game in different ways, which is fascinating. But she's like really focused on how like part of the game is just the information you convey and the information you take in. And so I would say some of the game of, I don't know, anything of working with a team is the information you share and the information you hold close to yourself, you know, and how you share that information matters a ton in a team.
Yeah.
You know, like how, like literally how people communicate can sound like a, you know, you're being yelled at to one person, the other person's like, oh, that's really inspiring. One person's like, you're screaming at me. And one person's like, I don't even understand what you're talking about, you know, because of how you're saying it, for example.
Yeah. Oh, I love that so much. It's so interesting because language and how we use language is so important in our communication.
Yeah. And that's another thing that people don't agree upon. Like, they just assume, like, yeah, well, everyone knows this is how I communicate. Everyone knows this is how I work. And then you find a team where people are like really confused, or that psychological safety is broken down because not everyone knows and not everyone likes it. And no one talks about it.
Fascinating. So when we were scheduling this interview, you mentioned something that you're thinking a lot about, and I was intrigued by this. But you said you're thinking a lot about internal and external locus of control.
Oh, yeah.
What do you mean by this? So fascinating.
This is another sort of term from the world of psychology and behavioral science a little bit. The broad definitions that I work with that are not scientific are that your internal locus of control is the idea that you can influence the world around you, that you have the power to create change, to influence, to make things happen. And an external locus of control, broadly speaking, is that you are at the mercy of the forces external to you, that the world blows you whichever way it's going to go. Things are going to happen to you. Everything is coming from the outside in. And so you have very little control in that situation. And this comes up in that book too, where she talks about internal and external locus of control. But so internally, I think I might have been reading this book when I first talked to you, I'm realizing. Like, this is like, wait, it's all, the entire interview is going to be about one book. But she talks about, like, the cards you're dealt are external. Like, that's, you have no control over the cards as they're dealt. But in your internal locus of control is how you play the cards, for example. Like, how you bet, what you communicate, you know, how the game plays out. And I see internal locus of control play out in people in terms of their, how they feel if they're able to make decisions or not, or have an impact or not within a team or relationship. And you'll see people describe this sort of in terms of status, like, oh, I'm new here, I can't speak up. You're like, well, you're sort of giving up your internal locus of control to be to the culture, whatever is happening around you, because you feel that sense of status. Like, I'm new, I shouldn't, it's not my place. You know, those kind of terms can be describing external locus of control. But I think that causes this dissonance in people at times, because they feel like, well, I'm an individual, I'm capable. They have a sense of self-worth. They have a sense of self-control, self-direction. They have a sense of their goals, their purpose. And so then they feel like they can't or shouldn't enact those in certain environments. So there's this dissonance between their internal locus of control. Like, I should be able to, you know, make choices here. I should be able to have an impact. I should be able to choose what I'm going to be doing in this context. And yet, I feel like I need to defer because of this external locus of control expectation, for example, is one way I see it play out. And I think there's this balance. It's not that one is better than the other. And the book that whose title I'm never going to think of, I'm going to Google it right now. But she talks about how if you, like the worst poker players, you make the mistakes when you confuse what is within your internal locus of control and what's within your external locus of control. There are things like you can never call the next card to be dealt to you. Like, you can't do it. Like, it's not what's going to happen. But you can control exactly how you're going to react to it, how you're going to respond to it, how that's going to affect your strategy, you know, what that's going to mean that you're going to choose to do moving forward. And so having this being clear on which is the primary way to approach a situation, that's where the answer is. Versus, I think traditionally, as you know, these like sort of rugged American idealist mindset of like internal locus of control is it. We're all individuals. You know, we control our destiny, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I guess like the actual response to that is like, no, that's not really going to make you fundamentally the most, I don't know, happy, functional, feel the most sense of connection in the world around you.
Was the book Thinking in Bets?
Yeah, maybe. No. It's not. The Biggest Bluff. That's what's called. Maria Konnikova.
Okay.
So good. And like such a fun read, even if like I'm not a poker aficionado by any stretch. And it was fascinating to read, mainly because of her sort of exploration of the psychology of bluffs and poker and lying and, you know, how those things play out, as well as her sense of locus of control that evolved as a poker player while she's learning about controlling her locus of control and making good decisions about it as a poker player. So it's just sort of two levels of her development as a person, as well as her development as a player of poker. And fascinating. Yeah, The Biggest Bluff. I'm glad we found it. Maria Konnikova.
As you were describing internal and external locus of control, I couldn't help but think about the pandemic that we've been in, and how in many ways that sounds to me to be an example of an external locus of control,
mm-hmm.
where
mm-hmm.
it's what you're dealt. And then if I'm understanding correctly, how I respond to that is either in line with my locus of control internally, or I give up my internal locus of control and be like, well, I can't do anything with this.
Yeah. Yep. And there's this added bonus called ambiguity tolerance. And I think Ooh. That's like the part of the pandemic that's adds a layer of challenge for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Though it's ambiguous when mm-hmm. it'll end, how things will yeah. evolve, how this is going to affect my work, my family, my relationships, mm-hmm. my, you know, there's this huge layer of ambiguity, timelines. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember in last March having a friend be like, do you think this will be over by Thanksgiving? And, you know, within this group of people, one person's like, oh yeah, it's going to be over in 2 months. Like, we're going to totally get this nailed down, you know, yeah. by May, you know, like, and someone yeah. else, I think, was like, I mean, we should talk about like 2022, you know, like there was like these huge 2 months to 2 year timelines, you know, at this point. And one person, you know, the friend who asked me, like, how can you tell me it's going to take that long? We're like, well, does anyone right. know? You know, like there's, right. and that was just really spoke to that ambiguity. And this one friend was mm-hmm. really challenged by that sense of ambiguity. Like, how, we don't know. How can we not know? You know, like just really ruminating on how we don't know, how we don't know, mm-hmm. you know, that yeah. this whole layer, and there's so much out of your control. Like, so there's the external locus mm-hmm. of control, which is exactly what you honed in on was how, like, we actually can't control a lot of things. Like, I can't control antivirus development or, you know, vaccinations or, you know, what if someone next to me in the store is wearing a mask? Like, there's a lot and I can't control, but like, I actually can talk to that person in the store next to me. There are a few things internally that I can do and mm-hmm. ways I can engage personally, my own choices, my own world, but my world suddenly feels really small. Like, yes, I'm the master yeah. of my house, but I'm only the master of my house, you know, like, okay, great. And I don't know how long it's going to last.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think where your willingness to experiment is a good example of really doing all that you can internally to respond accordingly. And I think that that spirit of experimentation is so important when that ambiguity tolerance is, I don't know if the word is high or if there's just so much uncertainty that you have to experiment more almost.
Yeah. I think I see people struggle a lot when they're struggling with the ambiguity because they want it to be known. Mm-hmm. And that's all part of external locus of control. And they're not accepting that. Like if they're not accepting that it's external and they're trying to engage with that as a part of their internal locus of control, that's where I see people like approaching sort of self-destructive mindset is like, well, why can't I fix this? I'm like, mm-hmm. you literally can't fix this, you know?
Right.
And not that I'm sure there's many, the psychologists out there are like, oh, let me tell you about the path to psychosis, you know, or whatever. And so I'm sure there's more science there that I'm not as aware of, but people do struggle and they set up that struggle for themselves in the way of how they're thinking about what's within their control and what's not in their control, but also how they're willing to accept or not accept ambiguity. And there are two factors. I think traditionally, I would say previous to 2020, a lot of people didn't have to deal with in mm-hmm. as tangible ways or as right. ways that impacted them so hugely, like every aspect of their life, for example. Mm-hmm. Like, are the kids going to have school next week, next year, yeah. next month? You know, people don't know. And so I think that sense of ambiguity is something that was, you know, when I grew up, I had school. That just was a thing. You just, yeah. it was there, obviously. And to have such foundational pieces be ambiguous now, I think is really challenging for people.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So it sounds like mindset is going to play even more of an important role moving forward.
Yeah, I think it definitely does. Like where growth mindset is, again, super popular. We love it. It's amazing. Yeah. And fixed mindset is like, no, it's terrible. It's going to kill you. But right. in reality, like many things, there are finer gradations of where if your mindset is fixed on having a growth mindset, you're sort of like have dug yourself into a hole too, you know, if this mm-hmm. makes sense. But like you can, like too much of a good thing is a bad thing, which yeah. I would say is very rare in the sense of having a growth mindset. But being willing to accept that you can grow and learn from things is still different than accepting the things as they are. That's like, mm-hmm. is like another layer to ambiguity tolerance or locus of control. Like all these sort of different factors. Like I see them like gauges on a dashboard where any one of them could be high or low at any given time. But growth mindset, for sure, I think is a, for me, something that helps me get deal with ambiguity tolerance, because I can still learn and grow even if I don't know what's going to happen. And I think that was learned, you know, spending time out in the woods where like I can actually tell you pretty well if I've been outside for a while, like what the weather's going to be like tomorrow, but maybe not the next day. And maybe if the wind picks up, I can't quite predict that one. So that's going to put a spin on things. Or if the temperature is going to be actually below freezing overnight or just really close to freezing can have huge differences, you know, in terms of how your day is going to go. And that's beyond, you know, my amateur eyeball prediction factor. But I think a lot of that comes back around a mindset where I'm still going to learn and grow from this. And I still need to be willing to try and experiment, because I think growth mindset can be, can come off as passive at times, if this makes sense. We're like, well, I'm just going to learn from it. We'll see what happens without actively engaging and trying new things or putting yourself out there to have failure, like actual failure happen or actual consequences that are not expected. Like, I think we, you know, want to give ourselves really nice guidelines to like, well, either I'll choose cake or pie, when you're like, well, you're having no dessert at all, you know, like that. You're like, no. So we try to make the ambiguity like ambiguous by putting limits around things. But to be really open to a growth mindset means like the rails can fall off anytime.
Yeah. Interesting. Speaking of mindset, you have a podcast called Books Applied Podcast, where you summarize books with guests and break down a book such as Mindset and how to apply it.
Yes.
So I'm curious, where did the idea for this show come from?
I did a staff training for many years with the Voyager Outward Bound School in Northern Minnesota, so leading wilderness expeditions for Outward Bound. And part of staff training, I don't remember how this first happened, but, you know, I'd been staff for a while and they're like, hey, does anyone want to lead a workshop? You know, they have sort of breakout blocks for lots of different workshops people would offer. And I had been reading really books I'd really liked. I'm like, I'm going to host a workshop. It's just going to be me bringing this stack of books and talk about what's awesome about these books. And so I did, and people showed up and liked it. And then I did it again the next year. I'm like, here's what I've read in the past year, you know, like, like a summary. And I did that for a few years and people were like, oh, I'm looking forward to your workshop. You know, like people would tell me this. I'm like, oh, thanks, you know, or ask me what I'm reading, or, you know, the friends you have that are like talk, well, you can nerd out about books anytime or whatever. And so then, yeah, this became an outgrowth of that where I found myself when I would talk with people like today, The Biggest Bluff, talking about that book, like I read a lot of books. And so, and I pull a lot of, I think, useful, interesting and applicable knowledge out of them to apply to other things. And so it just came an outgrowth of the, originally it was like the books I most talked about the most, you know, like I talked about mindset a ton with people and drive. I think I've already referenced that in this podcast. That's on there, a couple other things. And I actually did record The Biggest Bluff, which is funny that I forgot the title. I mean, this is really classy. I need to edit it. Like, so it's a podcast that's only on my website because I'm not as disciplined as you or many other podcasters I admire that can create episodes and have a structure and distribute. So it's only on my website now, but it's slowly growing this library of, books that I think are useful and interesting. And really, I try to focus on the highlights that are useful to other people or that I end up talking with people about or that I end up applying as a way to sort of help people get some of those ideas. But I, fundamentally, like the tricky part is like, I hope they go read the book too. You know, like that's great if people like the summary and like how I apply it. And if I'm having a conversation, it's easier, obviously, to connect, make connections to people personally. But I love books and I love talking about them. And talking about them with other people is super fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate, too, the clear connection to what you do with your business. So being able to take a book, apply it, and be able to share that with people, that's a clear way to engage with you, not only individually, but as a leadership coach.
I feel like a lot of the people I talk with end up with a bibliography at the end of the conversation. Where I'm like, hey, here's some books you'd like. Here, try this other thing. Or here's this idea. Oh, you're curious about that? Here's where you can get more. You know, I enjoy giving people, I don't know, I mean, sort of homework, but a little bit homework, definitely.
Definitely. And so, speaking of homework, what's been your favorite book you've read recently and applied to your own business?
Oh, like this is where these are great questions. And I have like apparently no long-term memory whatsoever. But I'm currently reading. Let me tell you what I'm currently reading, because that's really as far back in my memory apparently can go. I'm actually listening to a fascinating audiobook right now, which is not really business related, called Educated by Tara Westover.
Yeah, you're familiar, I've read it.
Oh, you've read it. I'm not done yet. Don't tell me what happens. I'm in the like last third of the book. It's fascinating, but it's a memoir of her life growing up. So and I don't know that that necessarily applies to my business, but it's fascinating, and I'm it keeps me running around in circles out there for longer. But the most like work related book I'm reading is called Curiosity. I'm gonna actually have it in my arm's reach so I can tell you the author without stumbling. Ian Leslie, Curious, the desire to know and why your life and why your future depends on it, by Ian Leslie. And so I'm reading that right now, and I am loving it, how it defines curiosity and what it means to be curious. I guess that's one of the things I'm like, yeah, curiosity, I love it. Everyone's, I'm all for it. Thumbs up. but it really is getting into, what makes curiosity work and what how we define curiosity actually matters. And I think it's, I'm sort of in the first, maybe third or so or quarter of the book, so I haven't gotten in too deeply, but I'm really interested in how this will then, you know, I read it with an eye to applying it, you know, I think is how I consume. And so how this is going to apply to when I see people being uncurious and how to encourage curiosity in others. Cause I'm very much for curiosity. I might learn, might change my mind on that. I'm sure once I read 100 more pages, probably not, I hope. But how to, why curiosity matters so much. Like, I feel like to me, it's just sort of like an undercurrent. I'm like, yeah, it matters. It's great. But like getting into the why and the sort of theoretical, but also sort of research underneath it is fascinating to me. And I think that'll help me apply that more to folks to encourage curiosity, like the positive sides of curiosity. And why that can help people stay inspired or stay connected or stay driven or move forward, you know, in different ways.
Yeah, I loved Leslie's book about curiosity. And I, what struck me was that he had the three types of curiosity, where there's the diversive curiosity, which is generally the that's generally what we think of with curiosity is like all of the different, he calls it the restless desire for the new and next. And then the epistemic, where it's the quest for knowledge and understanding, and it's like going deeper into things. And then he calls it the empathic curiosity of being curious about other people. And that really blew my mind and opened curiosity up to more than just, you know, this popped into my feed, I'm gonna get curious about it, or you know, curiosity killed the cat, you know, those kind of things.
And I feel like there was this, the idea of empathetic curiosity is really fascinating. And I'm, again, I'm not super deep into this book yet, but how I'm looking forward to seeing how that connects to the whole another popular idea now, which is emotional intelligence, right? And so if we're, and I think that sense of curiosity is part, a piece of the sort of classic definition of emotional intelligence, where we're curious or we're aware, we can articulate the emotions other people are having. And so having that sense of looking beyond yourself, but at the emotional states beyond yourself. I'm curious if that, I suspect that'll come in somewhere. I just haven't gotten that far yet. Or I will think about that and put it in there myself, you know.
Perfect. It's been a while since I read it, and the only reason that I had those notes readily available is because I've done a lot of thinking and writing about curiosity.
Yes.
And that was a book that definitely shaped how I thought about it. So I knew exactly where to go in my notes.
Oh, perfect. You're like, hey, let me tell you, because you probably use those notes frequently. And it is fascinating. Yeah, I feel like I just didn't know that much about curiosity, so I'm excited to learn more.
So good. Well, you've already shared so many resources and books in this conversation. Is there one book that business owners should read?
I want to go with a hard no. Mainly, I mean, I feel like there's, people need different things. Like, I needed to make a business card for whatever reason. Someone else is going to need to read technical design specifications for, you know, building widgets. Like, that's probably super beneficial for them. Someone else is going to need to read how to mindset and how to focus, keep on that growth mindset. Someone else is going to want to learn about motivation or other things. I guess I would tell business leaders to read what you're curious about. Because even if it doesn't end up being super directly useful, that, you know, correlating, connecting, pattern making is super useful.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, awesome. Sorry, another terrible answer of the old non-answer answer. Read what matters to you. Like,
well,
okay.
I think that's an important awareness though, because some people will just read whatever people tell them to read without understanding what is the next thing that I need to read.
Yeah. I think that just speaks to me as a experiential educator. Like, without reflecting on your actual experience, you don't really know where to make the next step and where to go next. Mm. And so that sense of reflection is important. Mm-hmm. And that helps guide the next action. That transference matters. And transference is actually pretty personal.
Yeah.
And so engaging in transference on a personal level as a reading list. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could tell you, I think I have 7 or 8 books on my little podcast that I think are useful and beneficial, but they may not be for you. Or, you know, the other 6 we didn't talk about during this conversation maybe are even more useful. I just didn't get around to it. Or maybe they're 0% useful. So it's hard to say universally.
Yeah. So what's the next book on your list?
Well, I'm reading Curious right now. Mm-hmm. I have a stack of books in my other room there, which is really funny because where we are right now, I'm in Portland, Oregon, and all the libraries have closed down, and I like physical books. And so now they're like, don't return the books. So I'm like, okay. So I'm excited that I don't have to return these books anytime soon. I have Moonwalking with Einstein, which is about memory. I'm excited to read that. There's A Whole New Mind by Daniel Pink, which is, I think he wrote before writing Drive, from what I understand, but it's about sort of understanding how the brain works. Just reading the top, I'm like, okay, the left brain, right brain kind of dichotomy is a little too dichotomous for me, but I'm curious to read it and learn about that. I'm trying to think what else. Those are the ones I remember that are on my stack over there right now. I've like 8 or 10 books that's
awesome
on the list, as well as, you know, the ebooks and audiobooks that I somehow stack up also.
That's awesome. Well, Iggy, thank you so much for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, exploring locus of control, exploring curiosity, leadership, coaching, and team development. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing, and I can't wait to see what you do this year.
Thanks so much, Chris. It's been fantastic talking with you.
If you love this conversation with Iggy, be sure to check out her podcast, The Books Applied Podcast, where she explores 11 books, and I'm actually a guest on the latest episode all about the book Curious by Ian Leslie. I hope you'll check it out. The link to her show is in the show notes page, gwtw.co/487. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.